Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Free and I'll Be Creeping from the second studio album, also called Free, recorded and released in 1969.
Pretty free, baby.
Free.
Recorded at Morgan Studios and Trident Studios.
We like Trident Studios.
We like Morgan Studios. They have Carrack Console and, of course, Trident at Trident Console. People used to flock to Morgan Studios because the console was so clean. They opened up, they got this Carrack desk in, and everybody came, started coming to them. But this was actually produced by Chris Blackwell, wasn't it?
Yes.
Who was the owner of Island Records.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's incredible because, you know, he owns it. He actually had his, and I think it was later on he actually built his studio. But early on, of course, he was using the other ones and Trident being, and Morgan being two of them. But, of course, this track is all about one thing. And what's it about?
It's the elephant in the room. The bass on this song.
Oh, man.
I was a bit high then, actually. I was just grinning so much I couldn't sing lower.
Right. Andy Fraser was, what, 16 when he did this? 17?
Yep.
Oh, it's just outrageous. Outrageous.
It's just fun. Just honestly, this is the best song of the whole album. And every time I play it, I just smile and I start grooving because it's just fantastic. And do you know what? Just stopping, I think this is the first time I've really started listening to the lyrics because I'm just so enthralled with the groove of this song. And then I'm suddenly aware that if you're the first line of the lyrics, if you're trying to screw me,
baby,
exactly. And then hearing that, I'll be creeping.
Yeah.
It's like, but it's lovely. It's really lovely just to listen to it, and sometimes listen to it and listen to the bass, and next time around listen out for the vocals, and it's like a layered onion, isn't it? It's quite beautiful.
Well, what I like about it is it's so clean. The whole thing has got a lot of space, which that this band were really known for. They were so laid back. I mean, a lot of their albums are quite slow. Mm. And they were only really around for 4 or 5 years, weren't they, Free?
I know, it's weird, but I've got to confess, I know this is their second studio album, and when we played it the other day, the whole album through, I actually don't like the album as a whole, and it actually only... And then, it's not that I want to use other people and chart positions to verify my own personal experience of the music, but it only reached number 22 in the UK charts, failed to chart in the US, and they released I'll Be Creeping as a single and Broad Daylight, and they both failed to chart. And I was wondering why. And the thing is, I don't like the album as an experience as a whole. But I love this one particular song off the album. That's my personal feeling about this album.
Well, I like the last track, Morning Sad Morning. That's a particular favourite of mine. It's very slow and sort of mournful. But of course, the third album, Fire and Water,
well,
went ballistic because
Big
On. Fire and Water itself, All Right Now, which, blimey, you know?
I know. And the thing is that you can see that you can hear them building together. They talk about how Andy Fraser and Paul Rodgers, their songwriting was improving and strengthening, especially in the second album. But crikey, I mean, by the time they'd retired in 1973, they'd become one of the biggest selling British blues rock groups, and they'd sold more than 20 million albums and done over like 700 arena concerts and stuff. I mean, they were huge.
Well, live, I mean, they were great. What I liked about them is that they kept changing the way their arrangements during the actual performances and stuff as well. I mean, Kossoff, whether it was drug-fueled or whatever, but, you know, he'd always change things slightly and do things slightly different. What I love about this band is the amount of clean sound it's got. I mean, the bass is actually quite dirty and punchy because it's got that big, you know, short scale thing going on. But his guitar, and nobody these days would play that song that clean because it is very exposed live. I mean, we do them and we try and do them very much to the original with really clean sounds, but it's tricky, isn't it? Neil Young and Crazy Horse, piece of crap from 20th studio album Sleeps with Angels, released on the 16th of August 1994 on the Reprise label, which was founded by Frank Sinatra in 1960 and owned by Warner Brothers. Did we know that? I didn't know.
Piece of crap! That's what I just want to be. I want to be the backing vocalist. Sorry, I just really wanted to do that.
Of course. Well, who wouldn't want to
it's
do it?
It's fantastic. What it fun.
It is fun. And what I love about it, it is, I mean, you know, he wasn't a young man even then, you know. What was it, 95, is it? Yeah, something like that. And it actually just sounds like he's got in a garage with his mates and he's thrashing it out.
Yeah.
I mean, there's confusion in some of the parts there, because I'm sure that there's a couple of bars that they hang on a bit too long. They're all looking at each other in the studio deciding when they're going to change. You can hear it. You can feel, you can smell the sweat. You can smell the loud, the valves and the hot valves. You can see that, you know, the drummer just pounding it out. It's fantastic.
It feels dusty, like it's in a barn as well, you know, doesn't it? You just, yeah. And they haven't washed for a couple of days either, and they stink of a bit of whiskey.
Well, yeah, you know, and it's this is what Neil Young is all about. Yeah. And to create something like that in the studio is very hard, because, you know, it is technically proficient. I mean, it's a pretty simple song. There's not a lot. It's just four people just rocking it out, you know? Yeah. But it just sounds fantastic.
I think it just says what it does on the tin, or does what it says on the tin, or whatever it is that phrase is, isn't it? It's very direct. And I think captures what I experience quite a lot as well, you know? I mean, the lyrics are fantastic, aren't they? Saw it on the tube, bought it on the phone. Now you're home alone. It's a piece of crap. And, you know, probably as a British person as well, it takes a little bit to actually get to that point where you give up on something. You just go, you know what, that's just a piece of crap.
It is. But I remember the first time I got this album, right, I had it on in the car, and the lads, the two lads were in the back at the time.
Yeah.
And James, of course, is like a bit older. And he said, Dad, he said, I don't think you should be playing that. I think this language is very bad and it might upset Joe.
Really?
So that's a shout out to James Campbell and
exactly.
Joe Campbell.
Exactly. And this is the dad that played Tenacious D to them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness me, yeah. And all these things and Eminem. And anyway, you know, it's
fantastic.
All cool. They've turned out pretty well under the circumstances.
They're amazing gentlemen. What I would say as well, though, just talking about this whole kind of Neil Young and Crazy Horse thing. What's going on with him? He tends to like... He was with Crazy Horse for a while, and and we know about Neil Young, I was thinking, well, who are Crazy Horse? I'll tell you another weird thing that happened in my head. I thought Crazy Horse were Crosby, Stills, Nash. No, seriously, because you don't realise they're actually a completely different band.
Oh, yeah.
I know, but I thought that was maybe... That maybe one member was in Crazy Horse and then they were Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. But it's like a completely different thing altogether.
Oh, totally, yeah. And these guys he was working with for years, because he'd do acoustic stuff on his own, very sensitive, very beautiful. And David Briggs, who produced this, actually did his first record in 1968. They became big friends. He died of lung cancer, sadly, in the 90s. This is David Briggs. But, you know, but Young... Frank Poncho, San Pedro, Billy Talbot and Ralph Molina, they were like the stalwarts of the band. And I know he got a different bass player, and sadly, I think one of his bass players, I think it was Billy Talbot, is dead. I can't remember now, so I'm sorry, Billy, if you're alive, but there was a bit of, you know, a bit of personnel change. But I remember seeing them with you. At
Beer Ritz,
that's right, at that festival, and he was just as frantic. And this was only a few years ago, isn't it? What, three, 4 years ago?
Yeah.
He was immense. They got into the centre of the stage in a huddle, the three of them, right in front of the drums, and they were rocking it out. It was amazing to see, you know?
I love that, because I'd never really seen that before, where you just knew that he was going, this is my band. We're a band, and we're going to do what our band does, and you were just there, and in a way, sometimes it was quite nice because I was actually just closing my eyes trying to listen to it, because visually they were there, and you could see them, but it was better if you listened, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And they're not poncing around trying to look good. You know, they're not poncing around showing off to the audience. They're rocking out like a rock and roll band should do.
Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, Part 1, by the Flaming Lips. And that was from their 10th studio album, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots. Sorry. It was released on the 16th of July in 2002. That's bonkers.
I saw them at Glastonbury. And I think it's probably one of the best bands I've ever seen live. And that's saying something, considering the rock and roll acts I've seen in the... Because the stage show was so bonkers, and it was bonkers. That's the only word you can... There was people, huge suits turning up. At the end of the show, there was about 40 or 50 people on stage, probably some of the audience. He is a genius anyway. I loved him when he did the track The Golden Path with the Chemical Brothers.
Yeah.
Wayne. Yeah, Wayne Coyne, yeah, sorry. Yeah, he is actually just beautiful. And I actually think that the Golden Path, his vocal on that, well, it doesn't just make the song, but it's just a great, and I think it's one of the best vocals he's actually done. But with this, what I want to talk about here is not the production, really. I want to talk about the drums, because a friend of ours, we were talking about drums the other day and about, you know, how they should be pretty straight up and you know, four on the floor and rock and roll to give a song groove. Well, this, it sounds as though they've got the drum machine and they've made a mistake in the program in the middle, because it falls over itself in the middle. It's obviously programmed in, or they must have made a mistake and left it in, but it's very disorientating, rather like the Jethro Tull track last week, Aqualung, with those blasted tom-toms, whereas they were slightly out, they sounded out of time. In the track, sound great, but, you know, you would never play them like that. And the same thing about this drum machine, you know? And it's slightly distorted and very... especially on vinyl, because, of course, you know, this is all stuff from our vinyl collections that we listen to. And, yeah, it's the weirdest thing. And what a title.
I know, Yoshimi. But also, Yoshimi Peewee was actually the drummer, session drummer, Japanese session drummer.
No.
Yeah, and that's what the album is named.
You got me there.
Got you there, sunshine. Oh, that feels good. It's been a while. Let me just bask in the tingling of that moment.
Is that like Basque?
That's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, okay.
But what happened was that she was doing the session on the album and someone made a comment that her machine sounded, sort of abstract singing, sounded like she was battling monsters. So it's from, well, they're just all having a good time, aren't they? So they're just taking the room and the people in the room and they're creating stuff from that. So, yeah, it was about her.
I think they're one of the most original bands, though, that have been around, you know, for a long time. I put them in the same originality category as Devo, really.
Yeah.
They sort of, come on, you know it's them. They're doing stuff and it's like, it's pretty crazy, you know?
I've got something I want to confess, though.
Go on.
That, remember when we've got that Flaming Lips documentary, that I would really like to live next door to Wayne Coyne?
Yes.
I really would love it, because I think he would be so much fun.
Yeah,
and I'd actually like to
great,
be. I'd love to be in the band, because what I love was his vision, and he was building like film sets next door and in the backyard and spaceships and making alien heads. And but you know, you've got all that one side, but going back to the fact that you said, I mean, they've won Grammys for best performance, haven't they? Mm. They are absolutely like kick-ass, amazing performers, and Q magazine listed them as one of the bands, their top 50 bands that you should see before you die. So I'm looking at you going, you've had that experience, I haven't. But what does he feel like, you know, when you see Wayne on stage and the whole band? How does he make you feel? What does he do? How does he connect with you as part of the audience?
Well, the first thing he does is he came on when I saw him in this big bubble, and he walked from the back of the stage and went into this bubble, and the bubble rolled across the stage.
Like a big hamster ball.
Oh, yeah.
Thing.
Oh, man. It was just incredible. Absolutely. You know, it's just a remarkable performance. But so what I like about him is the unconventional nature of the music, the thought. And I think they think differently, which a lot of artists that you see just don't do. They try and replicate something that's been before or whatever, you know. And I just wonder whether the recording industry, being in the state it's in now, whether a band like the Flaming Lips would ever get anywhere, because you need somebody to invest in that talent and to push and market them to the, you know...
True.
Yeah, and you know, and that's just not happening now.
I think also that we've got a... There's a repetition of people saying the same thing, and I think what if you've got something different to say or something that's unique of you, that's a fusion of other ideas, because it's very rare that you find something original these days. But in terms of original fusion, like David Bowie's a collator of influences, and it came through David Bowie and it became something new because it was his take on stuff.
Yeah, interpretation.
Exactly. So what we need is more people having trusting themselves as artists, like you say, and people supporting them to believe in their in changing things. Because what I've realised recently as well is that you've got to shake things up a bit if you want to change things. So sometimes that's that edge, that little bit of troublemaking, of shaking things up, is a really important part of creativity and being an artist.
But you've got to shake things up. That is what being an artist is all about. And what I love, I mean, the producer of this is Dave Fridman, who has produced Weezer. He was in Mercury Rev, the original bass player.
Yeah.
And he went on, he's produced loads of really cool people.
I know, like the Delgados.
Yeah.
And I've got to tell you this as well. And another band I'd never heard about that has been in this studio called Bass Piggy.
No.
Yeah.
Never heard of them.
Never. Neither had I. Mad.
People just ain't no good. I think that's well understood. You can see it everywhere you look. People just ain't no good. We were married under cherry trees. Blossom, we made our vows. All the blossoms come sailing down through the streets and through the playground. The sun would stream on the sheets, woken by Sunday newspapers. I never read a single word. People, they ain't no good. People, they ain't no good. People, they ain't no good. Seasons came, seasons went. The winter stripped the blossoms bare. A different tree now lines the streets, shaking its fists in the air. The winter slammed us like a fist. Rattling in the gales, to which she drew the curtains made out of her wedding veil. People, they ain't no good. People, they ain't no and a coffin of wood. To our love, let all the pink-eyed pigeons coo. Let people, they just ain't no good. To our love, send back all the letters to our love, Valentine of blood. To our love, let all the jilted lovers cry. The people, it just ain't no good. It ain't that in their hearts they're bad. They can comfort you, some even try. They nurse you when you're ill of health. Bury you when you go and die. It ain't that in their hearts they're bad. They'll stick by you if they could. Ah, but that's just bullshit, baby. People just ain't no good. People.
Cave and the Bad Seas, People Ain't No Good, from the 10th studio album, The Boatman's Call, released in 1997.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Mm.
What a strange, beautiful song.
It is. It is totally beautiful. And it makes it even more beautiful, the fact, when you juxtapose it against The Wedding Present, which was his band before, the post-punk thing, very aggressive. Ant Alonso, one of our big mates, he's living in China right now. He loves the Bertie Bat, it's his favourite band. I never really got them. It was a bit too, I don't know, for me, a bit too. But, you know, the funny thing is I saw a documentary, or we saw the documentary the other night, on Hansa Studios, which was the, it's a documentary every musician, every record producer, every engineer should watch. It's fantastic. Beside the Wall, Hans Studios.
Brilliant.
It's absolutely brilliant. And the producer of this record, Flood, was on there, and also Nick Cave, and it was showing the Bad Seeds actually recording in there. And he went from that to this, and, you know, the rest of the album is sensational. We've already played a track off it in the previous show, but this song, it really moves me. And the reason why we talked about it from the vinyl collection is that we were talking the other day, we were in the pub actually, and we were saying, what percentage of people do you think are intrinsically good? And you asked me that question.
I did.
And I said, I think well over 95% of the people are intrinsically good, because no matter where you are in the world, when you meet people, whether it's in India, China, Australia, USA, no matter where it is, people are generally nice. They take you into the homes, they feed you, they do all these beautiful things. We found it when we were in the Netherlands last week.
Jan and Yvonne,
yeah,
Van Eck, absolutely gloriously beautiful people and so generous and kind,
yeah,
and loving.
They gave up their bed for us to sleep in. I mean, it was just a remarkable experience. And then we get these complete wombats that are elected into power that cause all the bother, the people that they are, you know, that are subservient to these leaders, and God knows why, you know, it is, they're actually intrinsically good. And I say it's far more than 95% of the people.
What, it was funny because I didn't know you were going to mention that, because I was actually going to say to you off the back of this song, oh my God, you know, I asked you that question last week. But what I love about it, the way Nick Cave is just, how about if we just go from that perspective, well, you know, people ain't so good, and like they'd be there for you if they could, but, you know, that's just bullshit.
Yeah.
And And he, but he says it in a gentle way. It could have so easily been a punk, angry, like, oh, I'm an anarchist kind of thing.
Yeah.
But to actually say something very hard-hitting in a very gentle way is even doubly harder. The punch is double strength.
Yeah, and it's that waltz feel as well, which is a lilting lullaby thing, you know. And
there's a romance about it almost. Yeah. It's odd.
I love the production of that record. I love those horns just in the background. You know, it's just a beautifully produced record, deliciously sung. It's one of those things that you'd want to write and you'd want to have sung it, you know?
Do you know what's really interesting?
Go on.
Is that, you know, talking about the cherry tree. Well, when I was growing up, we had a cherry tree at the back of our garden. And I've got this beautiful photograph of my mum. We went up to the back of the garden and the tree was in full blossom. And I was just saying, God, stand back a bit. And I wanted to take a photo because she was so beautiful. I wanted her to have this halo of flowers. And the thing is I got her to step back so much. So she smacked into the tree. She burst out laughing and I took a photo of her. So I've just got this beautiful photo of mum laughing against the cherry tree. So when I hear the lyrics of Nick Cave, it evoked this beautiful memory of my mum, you know. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Well, people are good. Intrinsically good.
Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles. That was released on the 5th of August 1966. And it was the final track on their album Revolver, which was their seventh studio album.
Yeah, and the reason why we're playing this is the sad death of Jeff Emerick on the 2nd of October, who engineered this and many of the others. Beatles' most famous recordings, did Sgt. Pepper, worked with Sir George Martin on these albums with the band. And I've got to say, I was deeply saddened by his death. We just sort of got to know him. I just read the book recently.
I'm halfway through it.
Yeah, you're halfway through it. You know, we were friends on Facebook. I was chatting to him like last week on Facebook, and I just can't believe it. You know, died of a heart attack, went very quickly. But Jeff Emmerich was responsible for the sound of British pop music. And his influence has gone on for, you know, it will always go on. The sad thing is, I think, that, you know, he was just doing some masterclasses and stuff. And there was one in July and in the States, and I wanted to go. It was fiendishly expensive, so I couldn't afford it. But I really wanted to do that, and of course I'll never be able to go now. And it saddened me.
That's making me sad.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's one of those things. But I just want to, you know, I can't overstate the importance of this man as an engineer, because George Martin, yes, he was a producer, he's arranged, he used to do all the, you know, the string arrangements and the orchestral arrangements and stuff, book musicians, book studio and all that sort of thing. But Jeff Emmerich was directly responsible for the sound of the Beatles. And this track is one of his most experimental. The first time that backwards guitars and backwards music had been used in the studio. Lennon's voice through a Leslie. All these things were brand new. The drum sound is fantastic on that record. The whole sound is fantastic.
He was 18 years old when he did his first session with the Beatles.
Yep.
And this was the very first song he ever did on that track. And as you said, so he was 18, went in at 8 o'clock on 6th of April 1966 in Studio 3. And I love this, right? So you've got John Lennon, you've got the Beatles there, and they've written this song, Tomorrow Never Knows, which is principally about the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Mm.
And I think as you start to read the book, like, Paul McCartney is very much more a technical kind of guy, whereas John Lennon just said to Jeff and to George, I want my voice to sound like the Dalai Lama chanting from a mountaintop miles away.
Yeah.
Right, so you've got this young lad who's going, he's bricking it basically, going, okay. So they start doing some tape loops, and all the time he's thinking, how do I get John Lennon's voice sounding like the Dalai, you know? And that's when he goes, oh, I've got a Leslie speaker. And his Leslie is like an amp. It's a wooden box and an amp and two rotating speakers.
Correct.
One does the treble frequency and one does the bass.
Right.
So he put the vocal mics next to this rotating. He patched it through, didn't he?
Yeah. He got some engineers at Abbey Road to whip up a box to do it, which we do have. We've got one
of
those.
Yeah, we've got Leslie.
Yeah, and we've got the box.
I just wanted to explain it in layman's terms. So you've got this young 18-year-old in with the Beatles, bricking it, going, and that's his first task.
Mm.
So they tape loop, then he does that. And John Lennon was really tough to work with. If he didn't like you, you knew about it.
Yeah.
Well, they all did, actually, didn't they?
Yeah.
And he managed to do this kind of, he got it. And that's that beginning. This is what I love about Jeff, was that he was always experimenting and trying and breaking rules and just really, you know, because there were a lot of rules. He had to wear white coats and it's all very stiff upper lip. But it's like you've got to get his book, by the way. It's called Here, There and Everywhere, My Life Recording the Music of the Beatles. And you've got Elvis Costello doing this sort of forward, just, and you're just saying, like, if you could sum up sort of the book, the contents would be, Let me quote you on this. Let me read this. He says, right, if I had to give a précis of the contents, it would be the sentence, we recorded Tomorrow Never Knows, and then I went home and had some nice biscuits.
Know you love me too.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was All Your Love, I Miss Loving, written and recorded by Chicago blues guitarist Otis Rush in 1958, released on the Cobra label. And this is our dedication to him because he passed away this week.
Yeah.
And when he passed away, I thought to myself, let's dig some of this stuff out because, you know, we've got loads of stuff that we listen to regularly and it's right in the depths of our collection. And when I put it on, I thought, is this John Mayall's Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton for the Beano album? Because actually, the John Mayall version is a direct rip-off. And I didn't realise that. It must have been, I don't know, it's probably 25 years since I've actually listened to this record, 30 even.
Okay.
And I listened to it, and it's exactly the same, even the middle bit. And, you know, it's I couldn't believe it. So the Beano album was this great thing. Eric Clapton, you know, I mean, he's a great guitar player. But even the solo, that do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, was exactly Otis Rush.
But then again, Otis Rush, it says, borrowed the guitar lines from that song from the arrangement from a song called Lucky Lou, a 1957 instrumental single by blues guitarist Jody Williams. So he borrowed from Jody.
I didn't know that. You got me there, partner.
Got twice.
Well, was produced by Willie Dixon.
I know.
The great one of our real blues heroes, Willie Dixon. Yeah, they're amazing, you know. Mm. And he played bass on that as well.
It's cool. So in a nutshell with Otis Rush, because I don't really know much about Otis Rush, he's got this guitar style, apparently, that this West Side guitar style or something.
Well, I mean, these early guys, though, because this is about the B.B. King sort of era, you know? And B.B. had that very, very relaxed sort of sound, like a southern sound, quite smooth and stuff. And this guy was a lot more edgy, you know. It was more edgy. His vocals were edgier. And but there's so many blues men that were doing so much stuff, great stuff. But they're all slightly different. Albert Collins and all these sort of guys, you know. The three kings, the other two kings, of course, Albert and Freddie, along with BB. You know, they were all doing slightly different stuff all around the same time.
I know, it's fascinating, actually, because you don't realise that at first. And there are different styles of blues and different... I mean, it's just like that is the root, isn't it, blues? But it just goes bang!
Well, on that album as well, on the Beano album, of course, they did Hideaway, which is a Freddie King song. And actually, it's virtually the same, you know? So, you know, John Mayall, master plagiarizer, surrounded himself with great musicians, but, you know, he was the start of the British blues sound, really, you know?
So Otis Rush, wow, what a guy. He was born in Mississippi in 1935 and he went to Chicago and it all started from there.
Well, that's great. So we're coming towards the end of the show, I think.
No, I did not expect you to say that. Don't. I know we do it every week, but it's like, okay, right. So if you want to, thanks for joining us this week. And if you want to keep in contact, we're on Twitter at Susie and Simon, Instagram, and of course, Facebook.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio. So please tell your friends.
Indeed.
But of course, we haven't finished yet.
No, because we've got this band that I don't really know much about, actually. The band is called the Sensational Alex Harvey Band.
Well, these guys are total monsters of the industry. You know, I mean, you know, he passed away very early, Alex Harvey. He had a fantastic band. And the depth of his live performances, particularly, were absolutely incredible.
That's
absolutely
weird. Incredible. It's almost like similar thing to like the Flaming Lips, you know, in terms of like they're incredible. They do this, they do that, isn't it? It's like another alternative kind of. They were glam rock, I think. Maybe.
They were sort of horror rock to me. They're like scary.
Really?
Yeah, I can remember. This track is, you know, Faith Healer, which is fantastic. But the version of Delilah they did, that's a really good
now,
one. We'll have to put that on a show.
I know about that one. So if you don't know about the band, like I don't really, they say that they're one of the most unconventional bands that were part of the 1970s sort of like glam, or you say horror rock era. It was fronted by Alex Harvey, and they had Zal Clemenson on guitar, Chris Glenn on bass. We had Hugh McKenna on drums, Ted McKenna, it was Ted McKenna on the drums. But their music, it veered from prog rock to experimental jazz around this kind of core of experimental and avant-garde rock. And it kind of had these, they had these different themes from environmentalism to Chinese takeaway food.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember seeing them on...
What's that about?
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's all in their heads. You know, I remember seeing them on the Old Grey Whistle Test, and that's what really got me, because that's what turned the career rather like Focus, you know. It turned the career right round when they did Next. I remember now that was a, you know, which we've played that song before, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the Jack Burrell song.
Of course.
And, you know, yeah, so it was all, you know, very, very much of that time, that era. Beautiful, beautiful playing, great sound. What a great rock and roll band, and sadly missed. So we'll leave you with the sensational Alex Harvey Band.
And the Faith Healer.
Your body's gonna stop.